gave a certain
cachet to all the other campuses. Right. It reflected the glory of Berkeley.
But you, it provided a standard to aim at, and it also provided
people. That's what you,
right.
People that understood the problem.
Right.
Particularly, as I say, Glenn Seaborg. But also his friend, Prince Lawrence.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Lawrence was involved too.
Yeah.
Ed McMillan.
Yeah. Within the legislature, did you have support, understanding, or did you have foot dragging? What was the situation there?
Well, there were some legislators, particularly some from San Diego, very conservative in the city, right wing, mostly right wing Republican, who were opposed to our having so much land.
Yes.
I thought about it. It's private enterprise should have this land.
Right.
Commercial development, not the estate.
Right.
Property. There was one legislator several years earlier who had proposed and pushed for the campus here in San Diego. Sorry to say I can't remember his name.
Yeah. That's immaterial. I just,
but he was one assemblyman that done that.
Yeah.
And there was this very right wing senator, state senator, who was dead set against us.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, the legislature didn't play much part. At that time, the governor was Pat Brown.
Yes.
And he was thoroughly in favor of the new campus.
I see.
Mm-hmm. He was very helpful.
Governors make a tremendous difference.
They sure do. And I told you, we had 16 years of governors who downgraded the university a great deal.
Yeah.
First Reagan and then Barry Brown, and Pat Brown's son, Jerry Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah. For opposite reasons.
Yes.
But Pat Brown was very much on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And Clark Kerr was a powerful pusher also.
Mm-hmm.
He was the president of the university.
Yes,
he succeeded.
Right.
Bob Sproul.
Right. He succeeded Sproul?
Yes.
Yes.
He had been chancellor at Berkeley.
I see. And the term president is the whole, involves the whole system.
In this system, there's just one president. And,
yes.
And the president had nine chancellors.
Nine chancellors. Right.
San Francisco, Santa Cruz, Davis, Berkeley, Santa Barbara, Riverside, Irvine, San Diego.
San Diego. Right. Okay.
Glenn Seaborg later became chancellor of Berkeley.
Uh-huh. Well, he won the Nobel Prize.
Oh, yeah. He was later chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission.
Yeah.
Still quite active.
Yeah.
Although he's retired.
How is the business community organized? What are your relations with the business community? How is its support organized?
I think it's pretty good now.
How did it come to be that? way.
It was largely the work of a later chancellor named Bill McEnroe.
I see.
When I was involved, and also when Herb and Herb York and later Bill McGill were involved, mm-hmm. there was a lot of antagonism against the two universities.
For what reason?
Well, the primary reason was that these guys were all very right wing.
I see.
Jim Coffey, the president of the Coffey Press, was very right wing.
Uh-huh.
And there was a man named Marcher, who was a very right wing lawyer. I had a run-in with him, which gives you some idea of the situation at that time. There was a meeting here on the Scripps campus about the university, which I had another engagement, so I could just go for a little while and had to leave. But while I was there, I said that we had, the university had to have all kinds of people, all kinds of political views. It has to be universal. Mm-hmm. And Archer got up and said that this university is not going to be like that. We're not going to have any of those goddamn leftists for this university.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. No, he didn't use the word goddamn, but clearly that was his,
yeah.
That was his attitude.
This was in the 60s.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it was in the 59 or 60.
59 or 60, I see.
And maybe 61. And I told him that I had to leave, but I did leave after his speech. Mm-hmm. And the San Diego Union had reported this as my leaving in a huff, because which was not true at all. I told him I had to leave, and I just did. But they never recanted that. You never recanted that. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was a good story, that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really strongly against
the concept of a university.
That's right.
The basic concept.
We had a man here named Herbert Marcuse.
Yes.
And he was I guess kind of a philosopher. Quite a radical left-wing philosopher. One of his students was a Negro woman named Angela Davis.
Yeah, I've heard of her.
She was out in Altona. There's no question about her being a communist. She said she was.
Mm-hmm.
And the local papers, the Coffee Press, and the local American Legion, and the other groups like that. I started a serious campaign to get Marcuse fired and Angela Davis expelled. And Bill McGill, who later became president of Columbia, was chancellor at that time. Mm-hmm. And he took the brunt of that attack.
Yeah.
And it was really quite, it was a lot of pretty very, very bad mouthing of the university.
Right.
That was after I left, after I went to Harvard. I was only here really until 1961, although I came back for a while. I got fired after 64.
What did you do at Harvard?
I was director of the Center for Population Studies.
I see.
The Richard Solenthal Professor of Population Policy.
I see.
Uh-huh. I was there for 14 years. I came back here in 1978. The reason I did was that Harvard fired me. I was too old. In those days, Harvard made you quit at 66.
66, I see. You couldn't stay on one-year appointments?
No, really. You couldn't teach.
You couldn't teach.
After you retired.
I see.
And after this, quite early age of retirement.
Yes, sir.
It's gone up to 70 now.
Mm-hmm.
But here, there's no retirement. There really isn't any retirement at all here at UCSD.
No.
If you want to stay. I'm what they call a professor recalled to active duty.
Recalled to active duty.
I said I'm a professor emeritus, but I'm called to active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach three courses.
Mm-hmm. You do?
Two seminars and one lecture.
In the field of oceanography?
No. Well, as I say, when I went to Harvard, I was director of the Center for Population Studies.
Right.
It was a very far cry from oceanography. Yeah. So I really teach three courses here. One is on the best developed countries, technologies, science and technology in the developing countries. This next quarter, the subject is going to be Africa and the African food problem. Then I teach a course in human population problems, and one on ocean policy. Not real oceanography, but what do you do about the ocean? Then I sometimes teach a fresh impression seminar too. In any case, there was the city and La Jolla particularly have always been very ambivalent about the university. And in La Jolla, for very good reason, you have this institution which has had as many people as the town of La Jolla.
And takes a lot of land off the tax rolls.
Takes a lot of land. Takes a lot of traffic.
Yeah.
It's just bad business for La Jolla in many ways. San Diego is much more receptive because we've played a big part here in getting high technology industries.
How do you do that? Because that's one of the directions that Stony Brook is just beginning to go.
Well, what happens, of course, is that quite a few of our faculty members start little companies. Particularly those of the faculty members in engineering and those in biology. And others come here because of the university. Quite a few of them have done that also. Right north of the campus, the city made something called a science park, which isn't all science, but mostly scientific. Companies of various kinds.
This development has been in the last 20 years?
Yes. Almost entirely since the university started.
Yes.
1960.
Right.
But it's more and more as time goes on, of course. Some of these companies are quite successful, others aren't successful. Mm-hmm. They're successful at all.
Yeah.
One of them is quite successful is one called MACOM.
MACOM?
Yes. Another is Hybridtech.
Hybridtech.
Both of these are doing very well. Some of the others have never made any money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although they're still optimistic. That has come from from faculty members. Or staff members who a company on the side and very often quit the university to work full-time in the company.
Engineers and physicists?
Engineers and biologists.
And biologists.
I see. Not really physicists.
No.
But computer engineer, we're very strong here in computer engineering. Electronics in general.
Your library is nicely computerized.
Yes, it is.
I went in and
it's one of the great innovations that I understand. This wonderful man, Nell Hoyt.
Right. Well, that was it was an eye-opener to me to go up to this chap behind a terminal there and ask him if the library had books by a certain person. Bruno Bettelheim, I was interested in him. what I'm writing in, working on, is a field of human valuation. And I'm interested in the two poles of what there is to value and the nature of the valuer, the structure on both sides. And right now I'm completely puzzled by the nature of the self and what psychiatrists have and psychologists have to say about it.
Equally difficult is the question, what is the mind?
Yes.
Same kind of question.
Right.
What is mind?
Yeah.
There's a man at Harvard, or actually he's been at Oxford for many years, Jerry Bruner, who thinks about these questions quite a bit.
Right. I don't know him, but I've read one of his books. I've forgotten the title. I'm going at it from the standpoint of what is valued or what has been valued, because I'm an historian and I'm interested in the evolution of our values coming out of our experience as individuals and our experience as nations, societies.
Well, that's of course a sort of an underlying question.
Right.
And it seems to me there is some, people do change in the right direction. I think we have a better world now in some ways than the Greeks and the Romans did.
Yes. A much more complex one.
Yes.
We've had to face many more choices. Choices with a greater degree of difficulty. And that forces us to consider the hierarchy of our values, the rank order of what we're after.
Yes.
And you see people thinking on a variety of levels, circumscribed in physical, geographical, but also in intellectual terms.
We're still confined to the earth, though.
Yes.
The earth is rather small.
Right. Right. But we are reaching out slowly to the solar system, and we have one chap, Tobias Owen, who's involved with Caltech's exploration of the planets.
What's his name?
Tobias Owen, O-W-E-N. About 40 years old. Very fine chap.
I don't know.
Very, very fine chap. Holly Schaefer, formerly a geochemist at Brookhaven, was the one that built our department of Earth and Space Science.
That's really good.
Yes.
What's his name?
Oliver Schaefer. He died. He's died about 6-7 years ago. I know him at Brookhaven. Well, do you have any questions to ask me?
Well, I guess the question I have to ask you is why hasn't the State University of New York done better? You have this wonderful university in California, and you have a second-rate university in New York. But New York's as big a state as California.
Yeah.
And then more wealth.
That's a tough question. I think I can only outline some of the factors that I think have played a part. We can start with the governors. Dewey started the state system after World War II, following a commission which he had set up under Owen D. Young on the need for a state university. And following its recommendations, he persuaded the legislature to break out from under the Associate Commissioner of Higher Education its operating functions and place them under a separate Board of Trustees with its own president or chairman and with an operating officer and staff. And that took all the operating institutions, the teachers' colleges and the contract colleges that the state had been supporting on campuses of private institutions.
Like Cornell.
Forestry was at Syracuse, ceramics at Alfred. And then the problem was to get the kind of leadership within the trustees and at the level of the operating officer. And the legislature was composed of representatives all trained in the private institutions. You have very strong private institutions in New York.
Cornell and Columbia.
Cornell, Columbia, principally NYU, RPI. And there was a considerable amount of opposition to its creation, to its funding.
From these private institutions.
From the private institutions, yes. After Dewey, you had Harriman, and Harriman was supportive, but it took I think a commission which I think Harriman created under Henry Heald, president of the Ford Foundation, to come up with a statement of purpose for the system, which included a specific statement about Stony Brook, that it should be created to stand with the finest in the land.
Did this say that? That was part of the statement?
That was part of the statement in the Heald Report, yes.
Buffalo, too, I suppose.
It wasn't specifically stated that way.
Did I know Martin Myers and that piece? For Buffalo.
Yes. Well, Buffalo did not come into the system. It was a private institution and merged about 1960. And following the Heald Report, there was a transition from Harriman to Rockefeller. Rockefeller was a Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth. And we didn't have to talk to him in words of one syllable about the nature of a university. I think he took the Heald Report seriously. And was very supportive. I think it took some time to get people of quality in the central administration.
Was that when Sam Gould was there?
Sam Gould, I would say, was the first person of quality. And he came in 64. But before that, the leadership was not too good. You also have a very strong feeling of relativism. And even though they had planned to have four university centers, Buffalo, Albany, Binghamton, and Stony Brook, the central administration and the staff there didn't really comprehend the difference between a comprehensive university and the teachers' colleges that were being upgraded into liberal arts colleges with certain specialties, teacher specialties.
Was that Albany and Binghamton?
Albany was the best of the teachers' colleges. Buffalo was private initially. Binghamton was the upgrade, represents the upgrading of Harper College, which was the upgrading of Sampson, a naval facility during World War II. And an offshoot, of Syracuse. It's been the leadership from the center has not been anywhere near what you've had from Berkeley and the trustees, your regents. The regents in New York never quite got over the breaking out from their operating unit, which is the State Education Department, of the operating functions of the Associate Commissioner for Higher Education.
There is something called the Regents of the State of New York.
There is the University of the State of New York, yeah, along the lines of the Napoleonic concept. The university assumed responsibility for education from the cradle to the grave. So you have assistant commissioners or associate commissioners of elementary education, secondary education, all in the State Education Department.
And that's called the Regents of the State University.
Its governing body is the Regents.
But you don't have a separate Board of Regents for the University of New York University.
It has a Board of Trustees, a separate Board of Trustees. But the trustees, the quality of the trustees is has varied. They're appointed by the governor. There are no ex officio members the way you have. There have been some good ones.
How long are their terms?
I don't know.
One of the great strengths of the University of California is the long terms for regents.
I see. Mm-hmm.
They were 16-year terms. Now they've cut that down to 12 years, but it's still pretty long time. And after the first, at least during the second half of their terms, the regents are always co-opted by the university.
They become strong supporters of the university.
Yeah.
No matter how they start.
Yeah.
And this helps an awful lot.
All right.
We've also had some good regents, some bad ones too. Mm-hmm. But each governor, no governor can appoint more than four regents ordinarily during his 4-year term.
I see.
And I say there were 16 appointed regents, so that pretty much took politics out of it, because it took 16 years to replace them. And that, but during that time, you'd have at least four. You'd have four different governors.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Duke Majan is fairly political about his appointments.
Duke Majan
has the governor.
Yeah. Right.
I think we have an absolutely first-rate region in it. Jew in Los Angeles named Stanley Scheinbaum. Mm-hmm. Very, very thoughtful, mm-hmm. fair-minded, idealistic man. But I don't think he's going to be appointed. He's one of Jerry Brown's appointees.
I see.
He'd be replaced by a Republican. But, you know, we won't have a Republican governor forever.
No.
That's the point. What you really have to hope is that when you get a Democratic governor, you don't get a screwball like Jerry Brown. Mm-hmm. And I say thought that even was very much down on the university because it was an elitist institution.
I know. If it isn't one reason, it's another.
Well, you go on about. I'm sorry, I interrupted you about suing. You think it's primarily the fault? The reason it hasn't flourished as much as it might have is the governors and the central administration.
I think so. Morale is made at the top. I think. And you need people with a certain amount of vision. And for a while, when I came, joined the state system, the vision was, see how far we have come from where we were. No concept of any kind of national picture or national standards in comparison with others, other institutions. I knocked my head against the wall trying to get that kind of concept across to the provost with whom I had to deal at the time when there was no president in Albany. In those days, the central individual's name was, title was president.
I see.
Sam Gould came in and was the first chancellor. Then everybody else became president. But that kind of relativism, egalitarianism within the system, and an absence of any national picture has been... It's not a matter at Stony Brook. We've had the national picture right from the beginning as what we wanted to be.
Yes.
Because most of us have come from first-rate universities. But to get those who are providing the funds and providing also the restrictions on the way the funds are spent. has been a very difficult problem. The local campuses are a little freer now to spend money allocated to them across boundaries within the campus. But we had to fight for that. And Wharton was able to get some of the restrictions removed as a result of a high-level commission which he appointed.
Yeah, that's a good administrative trick.
Yes. It got the legislature to do a certain amount of it.
Yes. We, as you know, at the University of California, there's a provision in the state constitution. Did you know about that?
No. You mentioned some provision yesterday.
It says that the state legislature shall have no control over the university except to maintain the integrity of its funds.
I see.
Which means that they audit the university's books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This constitutional protection, or constitutional, whatever you want to call it,
yes,
is not anywhere near as effective as you would wish it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean that the university's budget is just one line in the state budget.
Mm-hmm.
University of California is $2.5 billion.
That's it.
That's all it says.
I see.
And the regents have complete control over the spending of that money.
Mm-hmm.
The university administration has. Now, the fact of the case is that if the regents don't spend it more or less like the legislature wants, they don't get so much money the next year. So they're pretty careful how they do it.
How much freedom does the presidents of these institutions have?
A great deal.
Great deal.
And that's a very important point.
Yeah.
There are some statewide restrictions. For example, as I told you, we're obligated by the law and tradition, constitution, I guess, to the university to admit every student, every resident of the state of California who's in the top 1/8 of his high school class.
I see.
And that has meant that the university is getting overcrowded with students. Basically, for the reason that it's such a good education, it's so cheap.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're a resident of California, your total costs are about $1,500 a year.
Tuition, board, and
no, just tuition.
Tuition.
What they call fees.
Fees.
They don't have any tuition.
I see.
They have fees.
Fees. I see.
And those fees are not really to about $1,500 a year.
I see.
The board of rooms on top of that.
Right.
But you have those expenses everywhere. And a lot of the students here in San Diego live at home.
Yeah.
We try to house on the campus about half the students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We house about 6,500 out of about 17,000.
Yes, but pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. Right.
About the same size, too. We're about 16,000
now.
Going up to 25,000 or 26,000 by the end of the century.
We originally had an idea of that the university centers would be around 28,000. That's been cut down to where we are now. I don't know that how much larger we'll be.
We're getting a larger and larger proportion of college-bound students. Excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom.
Okay, all right. You have several problems?
Yes. Our principal problem is the disproportionate number of undergraduates compared to graduates.
Mm-hmm.
When we started, I thought we'd have one-third graduates and two-thirds undergraduates. And turns out we have about 85% undergraduates and only about 15% graduates. And one reason for that is we don't have many professional schools. We do have medical school and the new School of International Relations and Pacific Studies. Mm-hmm. We're about to get a School of Architecture. Mm-hmm. And the Scripps Institution is essentially it is a graduate school entirely, but
right.
I'm not sure you call it a professional school. Yeah. And then we have a lot of engineers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we do graduate work in engineering. What we have to do somehow is build up our professional training.
What about the basic sciences?
Well, they're in very good shape.
Good.
Mm-hmm. At least they have been.
Yeah.
That's particularly true of biology and chemistry. Mm-hmm. And it was very much true of physics too, but but all the physicists are about to retire. Mm-hmm. And we recruited them all at once in 1960. And
right.
Now this is 30 years later.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem we have, replacing our very distinguished faculty with young people who will become equally distinguished, if we can.
Yeah.
As you know, that's so much a matter of luck. I couldn't tell you how we did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We just did it somehow. And that's a serious problem.
Yeah.
The other serious problem is, which is a problem of California, as well as of the University of California, that's the changing demographic mixture of the state.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting more and more Chicanos,
yeah.
More and more Asiatics, fewer WASPs.
Mm-hmm.
What about, have you noticed any characteristic intellectual abilities of the Chicanos? Are they over on the...
They don't measure up to the Anglos.
I see.
But this is probably not because they're stupid, but because of their tradition, their cultural... They have no cultural tradition of reading as intellectual accomplishment. This is pretty much the way the Spanish were too,
yeah.
Until recently. Not now, but they have been.
Yeah.
Chicanos and blacks, neither of them do very well. Asiatics do far too well.
Too well.
They're always right at the top.
Yeah.
And it may be that they actually have higher IQs.
I suppose to master the language, that they have grown up in, they have to develop something.
But I think that's a sort of cloud on the horizon, which nobody knows how it's going to turn out.
Yeah.
Our ethnic mix is changing more and more towards so-called minorities in California.
Yeah.
On Long Island, we have Italians, Jews, we have a good many Asiatics in engineering and physics.
Yes. That's where they all go here.
Yes. Yes. Right.
They're not interested in humanities.
No.
Or in social science. Yes.
One or two Asiatics I've met in economics.
Yes. The other problem we have, besides this usual problem of all universities not having enough money,
yeah.
Money is the mother's milk of people's universities,
mm-hmm.
as you know very well.
Yeah.
I learned that at Harvard.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other problem we have is our basically problem of morale. Community, of a sense of community.
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be much of that here.
compared to Harvard, for example, where I spent 14 years. We have a new faculty club.
Good.
But we're losing about $20,000 a month on it.
I see.
Because we're not getting enough business. Mm-hmm. People are actually just not used to having lunch with each other.
One definition of a faculty member is a person who thinks otherwise.
Yes, yes.
So it's hard to... There's a certain kind of person who really enjoys talking with his colleagues. I have a couple living in my house, and the man is Princeton PhD in physics, and he's the most well-rounded mind and spirit that I've met. Seven 800s on the graduate record. Or maybe it was the SATs, I don't know, but at any rate. Plays the flute,